everyone, welcome to a very special episode. It's a podcast crossover between Blockchain Beat and
Block Drops.
That's right. My name is Ana Paula Picasso. I'm the host of Blockchain Beat.
And this is Mauricio Magaldi, the host of Block Drops.
So where are you calling from?
So I'm dialing from São Paulo. I'm based here in Brazil. Today is the sort of end of our winter, if you can say that.
Yeah, that's right. So, almost forgot about that.
Yeah, we're experiencing the end of our winter, so-called winter, quote-unquote. And this is a super
27
nice
degrees.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm from São Paulo originally, but I'm calling from the north of Sweden, right in the mountains with bears and moose and everything else, all wildlife. But I live in Malmo, which is the third biggest city in Sweden, in the border with Denmark. But yeah, I'm Brazilian, as you can guess. I had quite a few Brazilians on Blockchain Beat. So you're not the first one.
I listened to a few of them. Yeah, great, great conversations.
So Mauricio, I don't want to take over. Do you want to ask me anything?
Yeah, I think the first thing that came to mind when we started discussing this crossover episode was to maybe, you know, you tell a story of how you got to where you are with the podcast, how you got involved with blockchain, and you know, I'm always curious about how people came to this sort of market, because not only it's super new, it also attracts a lot of great, great people.
Yeah, it does. It does indeed. And then after, I can ask you the same questions. And yeah, let's see how it goes. So just a little bit about myself. My background is marketing and communication. So I'm not a tech person, but I kind of fell into the blockchain world about 5 years ago in 2017. At the time was the ICO boom. People listening, we had like loads of ICOs, and I have an ex-colleague of mine reaching out, and he knew I was a community manager. I've written lots of content, and then he said, "Oh, do you want to help out with the content for our ICO?" It was a crypto exchange based in Hong Kong. I said yes, but the funny thing is I had a personal curiosity about especially about Bitcoin, not so much about the technology behind it. The main reason was what attracted me to Bitcoin was probably back in 2014, I heard about it, and it was very funny. I wrote an article about Bitcoin Brazil in the beginning. Maybe I think it was January 2015 in Brazil. So it was something brand new. Not a lot of people used it. But what attracted me to the idea was this decentralization of a currency, especially in a place like Brazil. I think if people listening and are not too familiar with the Brazilian history, back in the 90s, we had a president. Brazil was coming from the 1980s with a very hyperinflation. And then the new president came in, Fernando Collor. If you guys want to look him up on Wikipedia, he came into power in 1990. And well, basically, I don't know who came up with the idea, probably a team of people, was to freeze everybody's assets, like your bank account, for a year, to stop the hyperinflation.
I do remember, and the feeling was of powerlessness from like everyone that I can recall was like, this is arbitrary, illogical, and sort of turned, and like many people who were like saving to buy a house or to start a business or to save their business were immediately removed from accessing their own savings. And this was like something that sort of marked that whole generation. And there were like people who killed themselves out of the depression for losing everything. You know, looking at hindsight these days, I said, this is preposterous, right? This is completely irrational. But as you said, a group of people came about the idea that there was maybe too much money in the market, and then they had to remove it so that then the prices would go down because there was no demand. And then they ended up pretty much killing the economy.
Exactly. Yeah. And Fernando Collor ended up impeached after a couple of years. Not because of that, ironically enough. Something else.
Great, great talent.
Yeah. But Maurício, I know, for instance, I live here in Sweden. I think things in Brazil now seem, especially in the past 20 years or so, seem pretty much stable. But it's still, for other countries, it's not a thing of the past. For instance, I have a business acquaintance. She lives in Lebanon. She's a community manager. And she has some clients in Europe, and because of the accident, you know, the explosion in Beirut, the banks, the government stopped all bank transfers, like all international bank transfers. So she can't get paid. She can't get paid from her clients in Europe. So the idea that there is someone, there is a body controlling, and also the banks, you know, controlling what you can have, controlling your assets, is something that is not something is still present to this day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about the banking system is that they're subordinate to powers that be, right? So I think the very existence of Bitcoin is a response to that. And as you mentioned, what attracted most of us in the beginning was that this new form of store of value or value transfer was removed from powers that be because it was decentralized. So there wasn't a single entity that would say, well, now you don't have access to your own money, or you can't transfer money to people. And that was eye-opening, not only for those who were early adopters in terms of, okay, this is a disruptive concept, not only technologically, but conceptually, but also something that for like the regular regulated world was like, uh-oh, okay, yeah, this is going to be a power struggle. And that's what we're witnessing now, 12 years after the paper. Well, here it is, right?
You know, I think what the most recent thing that's been on the news about El Salvador with all the controversy. And I think yesterday I was on Twitter, people sharing some videos, again, like a protest against Bitcoin. It was terrible. It's a terrible thing. They were saying we don't need Bitcoin, we need hospitals. Which is, I think, I can understand where they're coming from, but I think the biggest challenge, not just for El Salvador, but globally, is education, is explaining what Bitcoin is, what are the benefits, why is it better than having a centralized currency, and also in the case of El Salvador, why is it better than be at they have a dollar, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, dollarization of the economy, so the currency. And so they, like, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the economy or the currency is very connected to the US dollar. We don't want that.
Yeah. So the thing about El Salvador, and from everything that I read since they announced that the passing of the law, I think, 3 or 4 months ago, was first that El Salvador is a marginalized country. They don't belong to the global economy. They don't. It's not like they have a global presence. Most of their GDP comes from international transfers from Salvadoreños who live abroad. So people live in the US, people living in Europe, they remit money to El Salvador, and that's a big part of their economy. A few years ago, they relinquished the control over their own money. They had a form of local currency. Then they replaced that over the dollar, because that's the currency that arrives in the country from all those transfers. So they dollarized their economy, and they, in that sense, they sort of gave away the control of their own monetary policy. So this is one aspect of the El Salvador economy that's sort of peculiar. And when the president passed the law that Bitcoin would become what they call legal tender, which is a valid currency for transactions within the country, that meant that transfers from abroad into the country would now be cheaper, because transferring dollars is very expensive. You go through all the banking system. The banks, the one thing that banks do well is make money off of whatever services or products they're offering, and transferring money is on their own realm of power. So you can't do micro transfers in dollars through the banking system because the fees are expensive. So with Bitcoin, which is peer-to-peer money, digital money transfer, whoever is living abroad can just send money to El Salvador through the Bitcoin network, and it's only going to pay the regular transaction fee on the Bitcoin network, which is way cheaper than what the banks would charge for the same amount transfer in dollars. So that was the rationale. The thing about doing this under the guidance of a law is that it sort of goes against what Bitcoin initially was thought to be, which is a non-power-abiding form of value transfer. And I honestly think that the protests were more in lines of, you're bringing all of these things and we can barely afford rent. So priorities are not in line between what the government understands and what the protesters understand, is, which is valid. And you know, hopefully El Salvador is enough of a democracy that would allow this public debate to happen. But maybe then, if they have, say, a national reserve in Bitcoin, they would then be able to afford in dollars to build hospitals. So I know this is somewhat of a sort of utopic discussion, because one, we're not there, two, it's all conjecture, but I think in all senses, having a government to sponsor Bitcoin, it's completely the opposite of what Bitcoin was thought to be initially. So it's interesting to see, because we're not there, but it's interesting to see that this is a topic of discussion. Because if it wasn't for El Salvador, we wouldn't actually be saying, well, can Bitcoin be the global economy currency? Well, this is a valid discussion. Why not?
Exactly, exactly. And like it or not, it sets something in motion.
Yeah.
We don't know yet where it's going, because it's everything's so brand new.
Yeah. This week it's going to Ukraine, because they started discussing adopting Bitcoin there. So it's
That's
going.
That's right. They legalized, yeah, they legalized cryptocurrencies. Yeah, I read it. And yeah, but also I think, like I said, something was set in motion, and especially countries, the developing countries, like Brazil, El Salvador, in Africa as well, I think they're going to be the forefront of Bitcoin and blockchain adoption. I'm pretty sure. I just want to do a quick plug here of my other podcast, Emerging Markets Today. And
but still, there's one thing that I think has not been addressed in the discussion of either cryptocurrency adoption or even the central bank digital currency adoptions, which is something that we can touch upon a little bit later, is that in emerging markets or emerging economy countries, there is a big socioeconomic gap to the point where a big chunk of the population doesn't even have access to cell phones. They barely have access to formal economy. And for anyone to be able to access crypto, they have to have a bare minimum infrastructure, right? And that's something that the cryptocurrency won't solve.
Yeah, but I would disagree with you a little bit in this, Mauricio, because although I agree there is a big lack of infrastructure in emerging economies, a big chunk of population don't have access to the banking system. However, what's the beauty of emerging markets is a mobile first and mobile only countries, meaning everything happens with a smartphone. People don't have, you know, an iPhone 12 or, you know, top of range smartphones, but they do have a smartphone. That's changing. That's changing pretty quickly, right? Like it happened in Brazil, for instance, until 5 years ago, people had smartphones, but they were like mid-range smartphones, like a Motorola, Moto G. But that, yeah, I know, right? I wrote about that. But that's changing. More and more people, they don't have, sometimes they don't even have electricity, or they have a poor infrastructure system, but they do have their smartphones and everything happens there. So they leapfrogged from what we have in a developing countries, that people had desktops, and then you have your laptop, and then you have your smartphone, etc. They jumped all this. They jumped the past 20 years and went straight to smartphones. So that's changing. That's changing a lot. And one of the results of that is a thriving fintech landscape. Brazil with Nubank. Everybody has a Nubank account. Or they become a unicorn. And I just had a guest in Emerging Markets Today. She has a podcast called African Tech Roundup. And we were talking about startup funding. We were talking about fintech. And also mobility, like Uber, ride-sharing apps. So everything happens with smartphones. And then, you know, that's just one. I see a bigger need and a bigger opportunity as well in those countries where the banking system, the mainstream banking system, failed the population, failed the majority of population.
Absolutely. I think the metric in Brazil is that we have 1.7 smartphones per person in Brazil. And that's mostly concentrated in the urban centers. My point towards the great socioeconomic divide is the interior of Brazil is really lacking infrastructure. So there's not even cell phones. And those are going to be increasingly marginalized if we don't get to that point. And I love that you mention Africa, because in Africa, there's clearly a like 2 or 3 decade jump between not having bureaucracy at all, meaning people didn't know if they had even an identity that was valid by the government, and now they have cell phones, mm-hmm. and they're operating in digital space. So that is a quantum leap if there ever was one, right? And
exactly. Yeah.
And it's interesting also that because of that, Africa is now a big focus of Chinese investment.
Yeah, yes, especially East Africa, especially Ethiopia. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also Southeast Asia. So I think, with the explosion of mobile wallets as well. I know in Brazil, people use a lot of mobile wallets too. So I think there is, like I said, a big opportunity for cryptocurrencies, or for a decentralized cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, hopefully Bitcoin, to work in those countries. Because here in Sweden, everybody's banked. There is no one without a bank account. Everybody has almost everybody has a credit card. So there isn't a need for it, as in an everyday need. Do you see the difference? Yeah.
Oh, it's big. I mean, I'm in Brazil. I'm in an urban center. I have two teenagers at home. My oldest son is 16 and has a bank account. So is this, I mean, of course, I'm way too privileged comparing the average Brazilian, our household. But yeah, this is certainly a trend. And I'm hoping that for the less fortunate, that the crypto will move towards them. Even if, like, if they don't have a cell phone, let's find a cryptocurrency that provides them with one. I don't know. Maybe that will be the case.
Yeah. I think I'm very optimistic. I think we are having this conversation in 2021. Maybe in a couple of years, there won't be this gap between people not having a smartphone anymore, because there would be different smartphones. There would be cheaper smartphones. There are cheaper smartphones there, you know, Android phones. And so we will see. It's a very exciting time. I think it's a very exciting time, especially for emerging markets in that sense. And with all these things happening in El Salvador and Ukraine, and I've read something about Panama.
Well, Estonia. Estonia is a big blockchain country.
Estonia, yeah.
Now, you didn't finish your piece, how you got to where you are with blockchain, with your podcast.
2 hours later, I'm still talking.
We got held on Bitcoin, Fernando Collor.
Exactly.
We came 30 years later.
I know, right? Back in 2017, going back to those days, I felt there was a need for it. There was a need for a PR agency or marketing agency that would be specialized in blockchain cryptocurrencies, because I had people coming up to me and said, "Anna, I went to a normal PR agency and they didn't know what ICO is. They didn't know what anything is, how it's a different dynamic, right? Even nowadays, is it the crypto world or the blockchain world is a different dynamic?" So that's why I came up with the idea of blockchain PR. And a couple of years ago, I think it was end of 2018, 3 years ago, coming up now, I decided to start a podcast. And here we are. And it's been a really journey. My podcast is not focused on cryptocurrencies, although I did have guests coming to talk about it. But I try to invite people that would talk about different applications of blockchain, which is very interesting. So there's another aspect or aspects of blockchain that attract me. For instance, blockchain for healthcare, supply chain. Also, identity.
That was a big one. That's a big one.
You know, yeah. It is a big one. That's a big one. Actually, talking about identity, I just want to give a big shout out to my friend Eddie. He's the founder of Original Mai. He's in Estonia. He's Brazilian, but lives in Estonia. And actually, we were having a big conversation around identity, because I listened to a podcast episode from the newspaper Globo and said that in Brazil, there are around 3 million people with no identity. And I was shocked. I was really shocked, because I thought it was something from the past. I think Brazil just, you know, is almost like a developed country in that sense, but it's not. And it really shocked me. And I was talking to him and he was explaining me about why not make a smart contract. Why can't, let's say, a hospital, when a baby's born, what kind of hospital can register a baby in a smart contract? Obviously, he's explaining better than I'm explaining to you. But it's very shocking. It's so shocking.
if you really give a step back and think about this, this is where the big socioeconomic divide starts. The fact that there's 3 million people without an ID, that means that there's a huge gap in understanding who these people are, what they do, where they belong to in society. And that's, and 3 million people is not like a small number, right? It's 1% of the Brazilian population. So it's pretty huge that this is still like reality. But here's the thing, not everybody is born in hospitals. There's this huge interior of Brazil which are underserved, including by hospitals, and people who are born at their homes, and that's how these things happen.
Of course, not just in Brazil, but in other countries.
Yeah. Exactly, and they will only be sort of acknowledged as citizens when they are enrolled in school, for instance, and they don't know when they're born. They have the name that their father and mother call them by, and that's who they are. So, and here's the thing about identity as a whole. Right now, in the regulated world, identity, your identity is provided by some agency or some power, in a sense, right? You're, in Brazil, we have the General Register, the RG, which is provided by the Secretary of Public Security. And then you have your taxpayer ID, which is provided by the Revenue Office. So all of these things are provided by an agency that organizes society. When you go to a world where everything is decentralized and nobody has the power over anything because the power is made by the dynamics of a market, there we need to find other ways to identify the people, each person individually. And that's the big challenge on what they call the self-sovereign identity, because someone who can't write cannot claim their own identity. So we're in a world where we're seeing what is possible, but starting off from where things are impossible create a big gap. So there's, this is where I feel where us, the privileged, need to come in and try to bridge the gap between what is possible and where things aren't. So this is, I think, where the big discussion should be, instead of, you know, what is the value in dollars of a cryptocurrency, because this is for very few people.
Exactly, exactly. There are other applications of blockchain as well. And also, talking about, don't want to talk about NFTs because I don't know so much about it. I think I've been, funnily enough, I've been having lots of people since the beginning of this year inquiring about marketing strategy, about NFTs. So I think because it's something so new, people are still trying to figure that out as well. And so I think there's still a huge gap in the marketing, even for people to understand what NFT is, what the value around it as well. But I think one of the things that attract me to the blockchain technology is the immutability and the traceability, proof of provenance. And it's something that, for instance, not talking about NFTs, but talking about art in general. There is this amazing documentary on Netflix, I think still on. It's called Made You Look. There was this woman until 2010, there was this woman in New York. She was selling all these paintings to, you know, for millions of dollars to millionaires, and they were all fake paintings.
More power to her.
I know. She'd done that for like 20 years. It was like in the late 90s. She just turned up in an art gallery or art galleries and then with a story that she has this client and the guy acquired these paintings from famous artists. I think it was Jason Pollock, one of them. And now the family fell into economic, they fell into a financial crisis and they needed to sell these paintings, and they've been in an attic. They've been put it away for many decades or many years. So she was bringing all these paintings and selling for 20 years until 2010. And then finally someone caught her. I don't remember how, but there was still a couple of paintings. They don't, even though they had expert opinions, they can't say if it's fake or not.
Well, that is a talent.
That is a talent. And they found a guy that painted, and he was Chinese, and he went back to China. And yeah.
Now I want to see that movie for sure.
Please do. It's a great movie. It's a great, it was, and you know, why not, for instance, have a you know, a painting or an art piece in a smart contract to prove where it comes from.
But here's the thing, and probably my great criticism about the digital era where we're at is that there's still a physical world that does not acknowledge or even care about the digital world. So there is this frontier between what we do in the real space and what can be done in the digital space. Of course, if everything that's digitally native sort of comes around as resolved in the digital era, but everything that has to exist between the physical and the digital world, what they call the phygital, I read someplace, it's phygital. And like, okay, God, now we're shipping two different worlds together. But yeah, there's this frontier between the real world and the digital world where there's still a space for fraud.
Of course.
So if I want to say have a painting and then like register that on an NFT, you know, there's nothing preventing me for like doing, you know, the same painting twice and shipping them into different NFTs, right? So
yeah,
there's still a lot of space that needs to be tackled, and I'm starting to see more and more technologies come into the rescue. Like there's a huge advancement on IoTs in many shapes and forms. Those are probably the types of devices that will help us bridge physical and digital world in a very controlled manner. But there's still going to be challenges to be addressed. But as I was saying, if we are to migrate to the sort of digitally native world, which is sort of the conversation about the metaverses recently, I think this is going to be resolved in that space.
Yeah, like I said, it's something so new that people are still trying to figure out. Because I can understand if an asset was born digital, right? And but what happened to something like a painting, like a Picasso painting, that is already...
Well, the highly visible pieces of art are less likely to be corrupted in that sense because they're famous, people get like all this security around it. But if there's like this mid-range artists that are trading, you know, say in the realms of the tens of thousands of dollars, and then can be done massively, well, that is I'm not giving away any tips because you know, I have no idea how these things work. But yeah, I can see the potential of, you know, disrupting things. But I do think that NFTs are a form of tokenization that is here to stay.
Yeah.
It's going to evolve in terms of use cases. I think art was benefited because it's a very illiquid market. It's not made of assets that are very transferable, and the NFTs made them so. So this is special. But there's other applications we've seen. Patents being issued on NFTs. We've seen not only pieces of art, but also like sports collectibles, which is ancient. There's been trading cards since the dawn of times. and now they're digitalized, and now they can trigger a number of other benefits like protected content or special fan experiences. So I think there is a whole market to be developed around the potential of NFTs, and not only in the digital space, but if you have, say, an NFT that can give you access, say, to the backstage of a concert, well, that is an added benefit, and that can be worked into the token itself, into the smart contract. So there is a number of, you know, applications we're seeing, and a number of that we haven't seen yet that would transform a number of markets. And as long as we can trust the NFT because it's sitting on a blockchain, you know, possibilities are endless.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And also, I believe now we are in a creator's economy. I like to call it creator's economy.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Yeah. And then there would be a way for any creator, not just for art, but also music or different mediums, to make some money. And, you know, I think I don't know if I'm being too optimistic, but when you see these big headlines of some NFTs sold for $6 million, what's his name? Beeple, you know.
$69
million. $69 million, my God. Or some, yeah, or something like that. But I think it's going to get to a point that creators, musicians, artists, photographers, you name it, would make a living out of it. Could be, you know, you're not going to become a multimillionaire like people, but you could make a living. Why not? That's how you make your living. That's how you protect your intellectual properties.
Absolutely.
It's how you protect your intellectual property as well. But we'll see. I think we just in the very, very beginning of NFTs and everything. So we will see.
Absolutely.
So what about you, Mauricio? How did you, when and why did you start your podcast?
So I've been doing block drops since December of 2019. The format is a weekly digest of the top three news of the week on the space. It's mostly focused on the use of blockchain for business. So it's not any form of crypto investment type of advisory. I don't do that. There's, you know, much better people doing that than myself. But the reason why I started Block Drops was I was coming out of working for IBM for 4 years, where I led the IBM Blockchain Services Latin America consultancy practice. So it was a very like early stages of the market. There wasn't an enterprise blockchain market before that. And I was very fortunate to be a person that was studying blockchain since 2014. And then when it came the time to set up the practice in Latin America, I was the guy that was like hanging there talking about this weird stuff when no one else was. And they offered me the job to sort of pick it up and run with the ball, and was a great experience, and probably one that sort of defined my, you know, subsequent years. And I've been, you know, I'm very grateful that I was sort of maybe the wrong guy on the right place at the right time. But it was very,
why,
I was
why,
very fortunate.
Why is that? Why wrong guy in the right place?
I was, because it was sort of a lucky strike, because I wasn't looking into this as a career. Right. I was I've been in banking for 20 years and I wasn't actually looking to sort of change industries. And then all of a sudden I was discussing blockchain with mining companies, oil and gas companies, healthcare companies, telecoms, banks, insurance. I was in every industry, and I feel very fortunate that that was the opportunity that was presented to me to actually sort of step back and relearn a number of industries that I had, you know, missed contact in years. So it was pretty fortunate. So when I left IBM, I came back to, you know, banking, and I was like, okay, so who's talking about blockchain for business in the, you know, in podcasts? Because I live in São Paulo. There's a lot of traffic here. And I was, you know, a huge fan of the podcast format. So I started browsing, looking for, you know, people talking about this. And there wasn't a single podcast in Portuguese that dealt with blockchain for business. It was all crypto investment. And I wasn't, I mean, I'm interested in that, but I wasn't particularly interested in it. I wanted to learn more about what was going on in the industries. And I still kept doing events to talk about blockchain for business, be it for media, be it for whatever the case. And in a few of those events, I was invited to record podcasts. And I was like, okay, this isn't that hard. So what would it take for me to actually tape a podcast? So because I've been in music for over 20 years, almost 30 years now, I'm a drummer. I've been in a band for 25 years, and I know how, you know, to, you know, do things like digitally on audio and all that. And I said, well, this sounds easy. And I started recording using this app called Anchor. It was before Spotify bought them out. And, you know, it was like, what's the easiest format? So I would read news anyway throughout the week. So I would start picking the three pieces of news that I felt was, you know, most curious or interesting or relevant, and recording that, you know, Saturday mornings in my car, in the garage.
In your car.
Which was amazing. The best. Yeah. Which was the best place I could get the audio. It was super early, so there wasn't traffic in the garage. In the building, and I wouldn't disrupt the family life in Saturday mornings. And started doing this, and then I felt the need to sort of portray the people who were actually at the forefront of blockchain adoption. So I started interviewing people. We have this segment called Block Talks, which is this one, where I, you know, actually bring people who are doing the work. And I've done, this is going to be my 43rd Block Talks, this crossover, okay, which I'm very proud of. And the podcast has been going on steadily every week since December of 19. So we're about 80 or 90 episodes total, with, you know, a huge number of use cases and pieces of news, be it on, you know, news about the supply chain industry or the healthcare industry or NFTs or what have you. Whatever is most relevant in the week, that's what I bring to the podcast. And it's been a lot of fun. It's been, you know, opening a lot of doors for me to continuously work in the community. I've had interviews that I'm really proud of. I brought Paul Brody, which is the head of blockchain for UI globally. A great guy, a guy that has this very interesting perspective of using public blockchains for enterprise, which is non-obvious, but pretty obvious in a sense. And I've been great. You know, I've been doing great connections. I've started doing the weekly episodes in English. In September, I think, of last year, because people were always asking, well, you only do this in Portuguese. I can't understand a word of what you're saying. And I said, well, yeah. And I felt, well, okay, this is enough. And then someone said, why don't you do this in English? And I said, well, because it's the first podcast in Portuguese about blockchain for business. I said, well, then do it in English as well. And I said, okay, so now I have to wake up half an hour earlier to do that on a Saturday morning, because it's two podcasts every weekend, both in Portuguese and in English, both in the same three topics. But yeah.
But that's why I like your podcast, because you do the same episode twice, one in English and one in Portuguese. But actually, we need other podcasts. I know English is a global language, but we need podcasts in different languages, in Portuguese, in French.
Well, then I'm doing my part.
Yeah, you're doing your part. You're doing your part. So don't stop. Are you going to stop with the Portuguese?
No, not at all. I love this. This is one of the things that I feel that this, I don't want to say industry, but community globally rewards is people who are self-starters and who keep studying. And the podcast is a means for me to continue to pay attention to the, you know, to the space, learn more, meet new people, and, you know, all in all, continue to be a lifelong learner. And that's pretty much what, you know, everyone finds a way of doing stuff that they like. The podcast is a way that forces me to continue studying and then giving back. Because what I try to do with the podcast is to really simplify things for the non-initiated. I shy away from using like weird acronyms or concepts that people don't understand. Mm-hmm. And I try to digest that into sort of more palatable concepts. So if it's like a weirdly complicated contraption like DeFi,
right,
I try to sort of easy on it. So people from, say, the financial markets understand that there is a direct correlation of what is being done in DeFi and what they do on the regular day-to-day, but it's done on blockchain.
Yeah.
So I try to make it really palatable for the non-initiated. And, you know, hopefully I'm being successful with that, because I keep getting a request for people to speak on the podcast, which for me is a huge feedback in terms of what the feedback has, you know, the podcast has achieved. And especially because not only I distribute that on Anchor and the major podcast players, but I have an ongoing partnership with FEBRABAN, which is the Brazilian Banking Federation. They have Numis, which is a content platform, and they have been really supportive of the podcast since day one.
Oh, wow.
So they also distribute Block Drops, the weekly episodes of Block Drops, I think since January of 2020.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're
You're doing really well. Yeah, and it's almost a full-time job. You do it weekly. I couldn't do it weekly.
Yeah.
Just for time constraint. Well,
I found this workflow, right? Because I keep reading stuff, and not only that, people like you and other guys and other people in LinkedIn, they are always sharing these interesting pieces of news, be it an opinion piece or just,
mm-hmm.
you know, press releases and all that. And I just go and I do the reading. And if it's interesting, I copy the link onto a Google Keep that I have with everything. And then when I find the three topics for the week, that's mm-hmm. it. I wake up in the morning, I recorded it on a Saturday or a Sunday, depending on how the schedule is. It's pretty easy workflow, because if it was like way too hard, I wouldn't do it, because
right.
I don't have the time.
Right.
Right. So I found this sort of steady flow that helps me do the work, and I don't really, because I don't have to think about the editing, because I learned how to record like start to finish, and I don't need the editing. The app does the background sounds for me. I don't have to create anything. I didn't write any of that music. This is all on the app. And, you know, I have to give a shout out to the guys in Anchor, because that is a very smart app and business model.
I totally agree. I think it was a game changer.
Yeah.
In the last, I think it started 2019 when Spotify bought Anchor. I think it was the same time I started using Anchor. And I think really democratized podcasts, because until
yep.
a couple of years ago, there was only Apple. And podcasts, they never really took off for almost 15
years. Well, Anchor has everything, yeah. right? They you record on it, you can edit on it, you can do the sounding on it, you can do the publishing, and you can do the social, because people can speak to you over Anchor, record, and then you can use that on your next episode.
That's
so
right.
it's great.
That's right.
And the business model there, which is probably the most interesting, is that it's completely free. But if you announce if you have this monetization turned on, they charge from the advertiser, not from you.
I see.
So for you, if you are a podcaster, you can earn money through, I don't do that because it's everything I do on blockchain is pro bono. But there, if you are to monetize your podcast, it's not charged from you.
Yeah.
The fees are charged from the advertiser. So it's a great business model. Absolutely.
It is. And unfortunately, I think in Sweden, there is this tool, the monetizing tool is not available yet.
I think it's only in the US, but if you're US based and you have a great, big following on your podcast, you know, that is the big chance that you can, you know, make a living off of that thing.
Yeah. And it's not that, I think it's that's great. I think I really believe in, on the marketing point of view, on my marketing point of view, I really believe in audio content. I think it's still very much underused in terms of marketing strategy when you having a product, or even if you don't have a product, but you want to talk about your company or your knowledge. I think it's still very underused. People still have really caught up in written content like blog posts or social media posts. But I think podcasts are really growing exponentially. And I really applaud Spotify to take over Apple Podcasts on there.
Yeah. No, I do this piece every morning on Saturday after I record the podcast, publish it, and then I go through the major podcast shows on Spotify, and I do this Instagram series of stories that says podcast mornings. It's a hashtag. And I do
didn't know that.
10 or 12 podcasts in the morning, and I send it out to the world because I think people need to hear it. So it's all sorts of things, not only blockchain, but everything.
Yeah.
Social economy, comedy. There's a number of comedy podcasts that I love. So yeah, it's a super, I love the format. I've always.
Me too. I listen to my podcasts on Spotify as well. I think another game changer was Spotify made much easier to discover new podcasts.
Well, they are the Netflix of audio, right?
Yeah, I think they're becoming like that, definitely. Because before I used to use Google Podcasts, I always had Android, first of all. But I only had a handful of podcasts that a friend recommended or I read about it. But now I listen to, I don't even know, maybe over 20 podcasts I follow, or maybe more than 20. But obviously I had some I listen more frequently than others, but I really love it. I think it's great. I don't know why. Maybe because I miss radio. I used to be, not because I'm a little bit older. I don't know about the younger generation, but I really do miss listening to radio. I think that is.
But for the younger generation, they can use the twice as fast. Because they are eager for content. They can use the twice as fast. Double speed.
I couldn't believe that. Maybe that it's another generational thing.
I can't. I really can't use that. It's been a few months since WhatsApp started with the high speed audio. I can't get myself to get used to that.
I even
tried, but it's just. Blah, 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 blah. You know, if I wanted to listen to that type of stuff, I would go to the jockey club and hear them talk about the race.
No, that's great. Is there anything else you want to talk about, Mauricio? I think coming up an hour now.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think one thing that I wanted to sort of react to what you mentioned about the blockchain in arts and how to make a living off of it. This week, one of the startups that I help mentor here in Brazil, Toon Traders, finished a very successful campaign of tokenizing a new song from Zé Cabaleiro. Zé Cabaleiro is a big artist here in Brazil. and they tokenized a new song from him. And what I like about the concept of what Toon Traders is doing, but largely in terms of what blockchain allows people to do, is to transform industries. It's really something that is happening, and it's not only crypto, it's everywhere. You mentioned supply chain. Supply chain is everywhere, everywhere. Everything you consume in your house or in your day life is provided to you by some form of supply chain. So it's very omnipresent. It's ubiquitous. So if we can make that, I know, quote unquote industry, because supply chain is not per se an industry, but it's like a cross industry service. If we can make those things more efficient, cheaper, broader with the use of this type of technology, that means that more people will get their stuff at a more efficient pace, a lower cost. It could reach further, and then we can sort of start bridging that socioeconomic gap that, you know, I feel it's sort of the calling of this technology is to actually be inclusive. So I think this is the calling of blockchain as a whole, is to transform how industries operate, how the world functions, how we can actively trust each other and do more for each other. I think that that's sort of what I feel is the real calling of the technology, is not just, you know, make people rich, really, is to actually
definitely
include more people everywhere.
Yeah, I think cryptocurrencies is just a small, very small piece of the pie, what blockchain can do. You mentioned supply chain. I've, you know, read a lot about, it's still on the trial phase, but there was this big fashion group. They own Louis Vuitton, Christian Dior, and they were doing, they're using blockchain to prevent counterfeiting in some of the products, especially designer products. But you can see something that is not so sophisticated or not so expensive. Let's say there is some companies, they track down wine or whiskey. So you know the proof of provenance of a certain wine, if you're not buying a fake, not fake wine, but if it is the wine that says on the label.
That is so critical, say, for medicine. Right? Let's say you have
also medicine.
Let's say you have like this complicated disease, and you have to make sure that you're getting the right sourced medicine. You can't, you know, can't play with that. This is serious. So if you have proof of provenance that the medicine that you're taking is exactly what you need and it's coming from the right sources, etc., that, and it's not counterfeit, that is critical for your, you know,
definitely,
survival. Definitely. So it's really important. And I think I usually talk about the traceability use cases, like the classic use of enterprise blockchain, because it's already is. It started with food and now it's pretty much everywhere, every industry, coffee, medicine, pharma. Why not? I mean, this is one way of changing the industry, but I really feel that we are in early stages, but there is like clear paths of adoption for not only industry, I keep saying industry, but it's really society, to really transform how we operate in terms of trust in all senses. So yeah,
that's definitely it. I think we need to do a follow-up episode. Well, in a year or so, to see what changed.
Exactly.
Talk about what El Salvador.
Well, I think one year.
Talk about Brazil.
1 year in this industry is like 10 years in any other industry. So maybe we should do that.
Probably, yeah.
I don't know, next month.
definitely. Well, that's been great.
Thank you,
Mauricio.
Absolutely.
That's really nice.
Absolutely. So, yeah. See you next time.
See you next time. Bye. This episode is brought to you by Blockchain PR. If you want to know more how Blockchain PR can help your business grow, just go to www.blockchainpr.online.